Thank you very much, Astrid, for the introduction. Can you hear me in the back? All right. Okay, so what I'll do today is try to bring together Roland Barthes and Walter Benjamin around a very specific question, and that is photography or the photographic medium, and the question of feeling. And I'm concentrating the talk on sadness, but tomorrow in the seminar we can discuss it a bit further, or perhaps the implications of what I'm saying about feeling in general today. So I'll read it out. The essential connection, intimacy even, between photography and sadness or mourning is one of the most discussed themes in the theory of photography. Several examples would be Barthes, Benjamin, Derrida, Susan Sontag, and many others. It was already shown that photography is the medium that has to do most fundamentally with the manifestation of the very idea of loss and the irredeemable passing of time. Photography marks the memento mori of our human existence and embodies the inescapable mourning over what has been. It is a medium whose self-definition is always and inherently anchored in its content intimation of such a presence of loss, together with photography's unique ability to eternally capture and present the object whose actual presence or life was denied from it. The nature of photography as the exemplary safekeeping of loss is what turns it into the essential medium of mourning. And I quote from Eduardo Cadava, who writes, "Photography is a mode of bereavement. It speaks to us of mortification. The bereavement acknowledges what takes place in any photograph, the return of the departed." In the talk today, I retain this important connection between photography and sadness. However, I intend to reestablish it from a different perspective. Namely, not from the point of view of mourning or loss or bereavement or the memory on the irretrievability of loss, that this is how it's usually been treated, but rather from the perspective of what I take to be a possible beginning of a phenomenology of photography or a phenomenological discussion of the photographic medium itself. Another dominant characterizing feature of the photographic medium is what is treated as photography's objective character, namely its ability to capture directly and accurately the object that it represents. In a text called The Ontology of the Photographic Image, which was written in 1958 by André Bazin, Bazin describes what he calls this objective character of photography, and he writes, I quote, "Only a photographic lens can give us the kind of image of the object that is capable of satisfying the deep need man has to substitute for it something more than a mere approximation. The photographic image is the object itself. No matter how fuzzy, distorted, or discolored, no matter how lacking in documentary value the image may be, it shares, by virtue of the very process of its becoming, the being of the model of which it is the reproduction. It is the model." This is the quote from Bazin. Of course, this was written in 1958, and we can rethink this argument in the age of digital photography and manipulation. But still, I think that although this may sound a bit strange or a bit old today, such a description of photography, I think that intuitively, at least, when we take a photograph or when we look at the photograph, this is what we feel, right? That we really want to capture the moment. Of course, we can manipulate it in the computer, etc. But that's, I think, in my perspective, not what we intuitively think or feel about this medium. For Bazin, then, the object in the photograph directly refers to the object that stood opposite the camera lens, at the moment the shutter captured it. The quality of the photograph or the level of its technical accuracy, the focus, the cropping, etc., has no effect whatsoever on this fundamental connection, on the fact that the photograph is, in Bazin's words, the model itself. This position is an expression of what was later termed the indexicality of the photographic image, a term indicating the allegedly straightforward association between the photograph and the reality that it represents. This indexicality pertains to Roland Barthes' famous claim that the noema of photography is the, I quote, that has been, that's how he describes it, the authentication, the existence of a certain being. These are quotes from Camera Lucida by Barthes. Or put differently, the presence of the object in the photograph expresses an unbroken correlation to the real object it represents. This association appears in the fundamental similarity between the real object and its photographed double. The bills advertising the first daguerreotypes, for instance, had this stamp on them that said resemblance guaranteed. So this is something that we can find from really the beginning of photography. These characteristics of photography, namely similarity and indexicality, were, needless to say, undermined and criticized by many. A criticism that even deepens when we take into account the age of digital photography and manipulation. Despite this criticism, however, these attributes remain paradigmatic of the medium and will therefore serve as my starting point in establishing the connection I want to make today between photography and phenomenology, or the phenomenology of photography. I propose that we think about photography's indexical nature by dint of the notion of intentionality. Edmund Husserl employs this term, intentionality, to delineate what he takes to be the phenomenological structure of experience. Intentionality, as distinguished from mere intention, refers to the structure of the human awareness of the world, which is broader than mere intention and characterized as directional. His descriptions are of the way in which human consciousness works, human experience is structured, etc. And it is described as directional, as an internal movement of consciousness that is always going towards its object. So the object would be the focus. Husserl makes a point of distinguishing between intentionality, this movement, and the object, and focuses on investigating the structure of consciousness itself, that is, without the object. Intentionality is defined, therefore, as inherently object-oriented, so to speak. The intentional structure is always underway towards the objects of its attention. Husserl emphasizes the importance of the role of the external world or objects for our acts of consciousness, which are no longer independent, thereby rendering secondary this egocentric, sometimes solipsistic account of human consciousness. Intentionality provides the conceptual structure that Husserl applies to explain the awareness of the world as inherently object-oriented. So for Husserl, this notion of intentionality functioned to strengthen his idea of the epoché, in that the focus on the intentional structure of consciousness enables Husserl to bracket the ontological state of reality, thereby inhibiting the acceptance of reality's object in favor of a focus on the process of consciousness itself. So it's a methodological bracketing, viewed as independent from the object of intention. Taking these terms into account, we can think about photography's fundamental indexicality that I described earlier as a possible form of intentionality. Of course, not in Husserl, right? I'm leaving Husserl aside. I want to use this term from him of intentionality. So photography's fundamental indexicality as a possible form of intentionality, in which the relationship between the camera lens and the object parallels the way in which phenomenology views consciousness's way of approaching the world. For the sake of our discussion here, let me say this a bit coarsely. Photography has an intentional structure. Okay, this is a kind of an assumption for today's talk. If we shift, however, to the second term at stake for me today in this talk, namely sadness, we find an opposite structure, or we encounter a certain paradox here, in that sadness is not directly related to any specific lost object, or more generally, to any object at all. The feeling of sadness has a non-intentional structure. To use Heidegger's discussion of Stimmung, sadness complies to the definition of being objectless, lacking an object, not having to do with a specific event or person that is the object for the feeling of sadness. This structure is the opposite, of course, of the object-orientedness of emotions, and maybe this is something that I can elaborate on tomorrow. So just to say briefly a few words about this distinction, so one of the important things that Heidegger contributes to this discussion of the structure of Stimmung is the difference between Stimmung and simple emotion. And emotion is, when I have an emotion towards something, it's essence is always this something, right? So I am angry about something, or I love someone, etc. So the structure is always object-oriented, so to speak. Whereas Stimmungen, so I take sadness, but we can also, of course, think of the classic example of anxiety or boredom or melancholy. One of the main things that define these states of mind, these Stimmungen, is the fact that they don't have an object. So this would be, for instance, the difference for Heidegger between fear and anxiety. Okay. So sadness is not intentional because it is not object-oriented. And hence, the unique movement of consciousness cannot be directed at anything concrete that is independent from it, from consciousness. A corresponding idea appears in one of Benjamin's early fragments when he writes, I quote, that the sad has no main focus. The sad has no focus. This is a claim that can be, of course, understood in relation to the aforementioned absence of object, but also an expression maintaining an interesting link to the photographic focus. So the sad has no focus, so we can think of this focus also through the medium. In his Zollikon seminars, Heidegger too writes of sadness and describes it as a disposition. So I quote from Heidegger, "When I am in a mood of sadness, then things address me quite differently or not at all. Here, we do not mean feeling in the subjective sense," this is Heidegger, "that I have a feeling for something," so something like the emotion that I explained earlier. "Feeling as an existential mood concerns my whole being in the world as my being a self." This is Heidegger. In all these instances, sadness is revealed again and again as a state of mind or a Stimmung that cannot be objectified. So in order to try and put together the intentional structure of the photographic medium together with the fundamental non-intentional structure of sadness, you see that there is an inherent contradiction here, I would like to turn to Barthes' discussion of photography in his Camera Lucida, and to Benjamin's account of photography in his Berlin childhood, Berliner Kindheit. So what I'm going to do now is to read or interpret Bart and then Benjamin, and to show how this intentional and non-intentional come together, or to ask whether they can come together. So I concentrate on one case that appears in both texts, namely that of the photographic portrait, and not just photography in general. I focus on the portrait since this photographic genre presents most clearly the question of indexicality and intentionality. It's the portrait of someone, and distinctly poses the problem of similarity and identification that I mentioned earlier, of the photographed object. So the face that appears in the portrait has an unquestionable ability to adequately represent the human subject standing in front of the camera. Namely, its nature is undeniably referential. There is a very direct reference between the photographic portrait and the person. The first question that the photographic portrait raises, therefore, is that of the measure of identity or resemblance between the photographed face and the object it represents. Bald concerns precisely this when he famously describes himself as going through his mother's photographs in order to find her. This is the second part of Camera Lucida. I want to quote now from Bart. I was sitting down to contemplate the photographs. I was not engulfing myself in them. I was sorting them. But none seemed to me really right, he writes. Neither as a photographic performance nor as a living resurrection of the beloved face. End quote. And then, somewhere in the middle of the book, after going over several of his mother's portraits, Bart raises what he calls the essential question, namely, did I recognize her, he asks. This is after the death of his mother. I assume you know the text. At first, he answers that he could only recognize her in bits and pieces, in fragments, here and there. A region of her face seemed familiar. A proportion between her nose and her forehead, her arms, so a little bit here and a little bit there. But all these loose connections between the photographs and his memory of his mother remain only fragmentary. Barth writes that he, I'm quoting, missed her being and therefore missed her altogether. He adds, it was not she, and yet it was no one else. I would have recognized her among thousands of other women, yet I did not find her. This distinction between recognizing her and finding her is very interesting in Bart. So he goes over the pictures and is not satisfied. To put it in different terms, Bart identifies the photographed person as his mother. So you recall the indexicality, right? Of course, he knows this is his mother and this is not his mother. He knows it is her. He identifies, but he does not recognize her. This essential difference between identification and recognition is of utmost importance in the context of this question of indexicality. Bart identifies his mother. He never doubts the what he calls the has-been of the photograph, namely the fact that his mother did, in fact, stand in front of the camera on that very day. So the fact that she was there is something that he does not deny. In that sense, the photographed portrait refers to his mother, points at her. However, this does not lead Bart to say that he recognizes her in it. All that he is confronted with is the Sisyphean labor to, I quote, climb back down without having seen it and to begin all over again. So he describes this really difficult, painful process of trying to recognize her, trying again and again, but with no success. Towards the end of the text, Bard discusses the question of similarity or likeness in photography. I quote, "I must ask myself," he writes, "who is like what? Resemblance is a conformity, but to what? To an identity. Now, this identity is imprecise to the point where I can continue to speak of likeness without ever having seen the model. Likeness leaves me unsatisfied and somehow skeptical." So this is Bart. George Didi Huberman makes a similar remark when he asks, "Whom does this photographed face resemble? Exactly whose face is photographed? In the end, doesn't a photograph resemble just anyone? One points a finger at resembling as an unstable, vain, and phantasmatic temporal motion. One interrogates the drama of imaginary evidence." This was Huberman, Didi Huberman. These claims bring up again the polarity between identification and recognition. Likeness leaves Bart unsatisfied, since what he is looking for is not to be found, essentially not to be found, and not contingently. So he's, so to speak, asking the wrong question. In the photographic representation of his mother's face, be it the most accurate, faithful photograph, it cannot be found. She cannot be recognized. "Such a representation," Bart writes, "ultimately looks like anyone except the person it represents." I'm going to read it again. "It looks like anyone except the person it represents. The intentional structure, that in which there is an invisible yet imaginable line linking between the mother's portrait and her actual living face, leaves us with an empty resemblance." So again, it's an identification, a resemblance, but it's empty. "A resemblance which grants Bart nothing but its own empty repetition." But as you probably know, Bart does find his mother eventually in the famous Winter Garden photograph. That's how he calls it in the book. This is an old photograph with blunted corners, an almost fading sepia print, which, I quote, "just managed to show," as Bart tells us, "his mother when she was 5 years old, standing a little bit behind her seven-year-old brother at the end of a little wooden bridge in a glassed-in conservatory, which is the Winter Garden, in the house where his mother was born, her childhood house. Her brother leaning against the bridge railing, extending one arm, and she, his mother, holding her fingers in an awkward gesture." This is a description from Bob. Now I want to show you somehow a picture of Balt, not his mother, despite the skirt, that he's holding his hands exactly in the way that she describes her holding her hands. Now, I'm saying that he describes her holding her hands because, as some of you may know, this photograph, the Winter Garden photograph, is not in the book. It is, I think, the only photograph that he discusses in the book that is not in the book. Okay. So in this photograph, the Winter Garden photograph, Bart does not identify his mother. He recognizes her. I'm quoting, "I studied the little girl and at last rediscovered my mother." So, of course, he does not identify her because she's 5 years old and he was not alive when she was 5 years old. But precisely there, when she was a child, he recognizes her. He finds what he was looking for. It is here where his mother is photographed as a child, many years before he was born, with a face that he cannot, in principle, identify. A photograph where there is no likeness or resemblance to the way his mother appeared in his eyes. It is here that he finds her. And the truth, I'm quoting, "the truth of the face he loved." that's how he describes it. So you have to see here that he's using the word truth, not only as some kind of a subjective, we can say, recognition of his mother, but this is the truth. There, standing beneath the palm trees of the winter garden, is his true mother, and not a photographed figure that resembles the mother. To take Barthes' claim a bit further, we can even say that it is precisely because there is no resemblance, no possibility of identifying, that her image can appear to him so compellingly, that he can be satisfied, that he can find what he couldn't find before. Barthes recognizes her through the elusive quality of what he describes as the brightness of her eyes. Not even her eyes themselves, the brightness of her eyes. I'm quoting, "For the moment, it was a quite physical luminosity, the photographic trace of a color, the blue-green of her pupils." A recognition that does not stem from any form of identification or likeness, but rather from the quality of her gaze as a five-year-old. A gaze looking out of the photograph, directed at the photographer, that Barthes imagines as saying to his mother, "Step forward a little bit so that I can see you." So he says, well, this is what probably the photographer told my mother as a child. Or maybe a gaze directed at him, at Barthes, the viewer of the photograph. Barthes notes in brackets, "Certainly, this is the sad disappointment I experience looking at the ordinary photographs of my mother, whereas the only one which has given me the splendor of her truth is precisely a lost, remote photograph, one which does not look like her, the photograph of a child I never knew." What I read just now appears in brackets in the text, and if you take a look again at the text after this talk, you'll see that many of the most important points that he raises appear in brackets in this text. Barthes recognizes his mother in a moment that could never have happened, and therefore a moment that could never be captured, a moment outside of time, in which a five-year-old mother is looking at her 65-year-old son, in a text that was published 2 months before Barthes' death. The impossibility of this moment might be the reason why this photograph is one of the two images Barthes discusses in the book, but are not reprinted in it. The other photograph was lost. So two images don't appear in the book. One because he does not have it, and the other one, which is the winter garden, because he does not want to display it in the book. To this, he writes again in brackets, as all the important things in the book, "I cannot reproduce the winter garden photograph. It exists only for me. For you, it would be nothing but an indifferent picture, one of the thousands manifestations of the ordinary. It cannot establish an objectivity in the positive sense of the term. At most, it would interest your studium. But in it, for you, no wound." So one of the most probably famous claims in the book is this idea of the punctum and the way in which the image wounds us. And this is the criteria for him, right? So he does not want to display this image in the book because it will not wound us. It can only wound him. The photograph is not reproduced in the book because it does not matter. For Barthes, there's no use to present his readers with some kind of evidence to what he has found. The punctum of this finding belongs to him alone. We can, of course, identify his mother, but none of us can essentially be wounded by this recognition. It is important to remember that what lies in the heart of the book of Camera Lucida is Barthes' attempt to seek not his mother, but the very essence of photography. This is the heart of the book. It's not a book about his mother or the memories of his mother. The essence that springs out of the winter garden photograph, however, is invisible in the book, intentionally left invisible. That is to say, the essence of photography does not lie in anything that can be pointed at in a photograph or even in the camera. It does not have to do with a certain thing that we find in the image. This is why Barthes insists that the Winter Garden photograph remains an invisible image. What I want to say here is that this decision not to include the image is not only, or does not, I think, cannot only be explained only in this realm of memories, personal memories, subjective relationship with the mother, etc., but also has further implications regarding photography or the meaning of photography for Barthes. The wound that this photograph pierces into Barthes, the punctum, is therefore not objective. It cannot be pointed at in the photograph. And it is also not subjective. It does not belong solely to Barthes' own memory. It has to do with this unique feeling that is comprised, on the one hand, of a pressing urge to seek, to find something, a movement of consciousness, like the one I described in Husserl, and on the other hand, the essential objectlessness or lack of object of this seeking. This is a very important point. So what we find here, another kind of inner contradiction, is trying to find something that cannot be found. It is like Stimmung in the sense that I have a feeling that takes over me, but it has no object. It has no concrete reason and no concrete purpose, right? It's just a feeling as a feeling. This internal movement marks the moment in which the intentionality of photography collapses into the non-intentional structure of a sadness. So the intentionality or indexical nature of photography collapses into sadness, into feeling, which is non-intentional. So at this point, I would like to turn to Benjamin, specifically to his discussion of a childhood photograph to which he refers in three different instances. In Berliner Kindheit, in A Little History of Photography, which we'll probably discuss tomorrow, and the essay on Franz Kafka. These three references were discussed before me, of course, by many, many, many of Benjamin's interpreters, including Kadava and Günther and Nirad and many others, concentrating mainly on what can be described as a mistake in identification. I will soon show you the images. Or in a different interpretation, an unconsciousness pointing from Benjamin's side on the nature of photography. So we'll have, now I'll present it. So it is a very, very famous discussion in secondary literature about Benjamin. So this mistake that he makes between his own image as a child and Kafka's image as a child, which I'll show you. So let me recount this relatively well-known debate very briefly, just for the sake of discussion. So in Berliner Kindheit, Benjamin describes himself when he was a child standing in the photographer's studios. Now I'll show you the picture. I'm quoting now from Benjamin about this picture. I was offered up to a crudely painted prospect of the Alps. You see, it's a poster of the Alps behind him. And my right hand, which had a kidskin hat, okay, cast its shadow on the clouds and snow fields of the backdrop. But the tortured smile on the lips of the little mountaineer is not as disturbing as the look I take in now from the child's face, which lied in the shadow of a potted palm. I don't know if you can see it here. So it's like a palm tree from a pot. Probably it was cut. I'm standing there bareheaded with no hat, my left hand holding a giant sombrero, which I dangle with studied grace. My right hand is occupied with a walking stick whose curved handle can be seen in the foreground while its tip remains hidden in the cluster of feathers spilling from the garden table. Okay? So, you see the stick, right? This is a relatively faithful description of an existing childhood photograph in which Benjamin stands to the right of his younger brother, Georg, that is not mentioned in this description. On the background of a painting or a photograph of a mountain view. The description is faithful apart from one detail. In this photograph, Benjamin is not holding a giant sombrero, like he says he is, at all. He is bareheaded, and it is in fact his brother that is holding, but not wearing, a hat, which is a rather small black hat, very far from being a giant sombrero. It turns out that this small inaccuracy in the description belongs, in fact, to a different photograph altogether, a childhood photograph of Franz Kafka. So you see the problem, right? So the hat is, this is Benjamin, right, on that side. So the hat is on his brother's head and not on his head, and he's not holding it in his hand, but wearing it. Okay, this is the picture of Kafka. In the two other texts aforementioned, Benjamin describes this photograph of Kafka, emphasizing the giant hat that Kafka is holding, and Kafka is holding a giant hat. I quote from Little History of Photography, the subject, that is Kafka, holds in his left hand an inordinately large, broad-brimmed hat, such as a Spaniard's, so a sombrero. And this is, of course, an almost similar description that appears in the third text, the text on Kafka. The giant hat, missing from his own photograph as a child, reappears in Kafka's childhood photograph. Now, I want to show you the two together. In other words, what Benjamin's descriptions attest to is that he either confused between himself and Kafka, or unconsciously, and this is what the main literature wants to claim, planted Kafka's hat into his own photograph. The third option, according to which this is an intentional mistake on Benjamin's part, seems to me just unreasonable, so I'm not even mentioning it. So to glance again for a moment in another book by Barth, which is called Barth, so Barth on Barth, we find a childhood photograph of Barth. I want to show it to you. We'll soon come back to this. So I'm jumping to Barth, a child photograph of Barth who is wearing a sombrero. Okay, that was just an anecdote. Okay, but it's a great anecdote. All right, so according to one of Benjamin's interpreters, Kadava, Benjamin's confusion between himself and Kafka, this odd admixture of the two children, conceals and reveals at the same time Benjamin's identification with Kafka, or in other words, is a way for Benjamin to present his own self-portrait as a portrait of Kafka. So that, I'm quoting Kadava, being like the image that is like Kafka, therefore means no longer having a substantial identity. So the claim is something like a mixture of identities here. There is a lot to say, of course, about this relationship between Benjamin and Kafka, aside from the images. And the question of the identification between them can be very interesting and significant. I would like, however, to give an account of this mistaken identification, not in relation to Benjamin's relation to Kafka, but rather Benjamin's relation to Barth. Okay, so now I'm leaving this famous debate aside, and I want to bring Benjamin back to Barth. I'd like to offer a rather unexpected intersection between Barth and Benjamin here. Looking at both of the texts together, the Camera Lucida and the Mother and Benjamin, we find several intriguing points of correspondence. Barth finds his mother in a missing photograph of a 5-year-old girl that he does not identify but recognize as his mother. This recognition has to do with what he describes as a certain unique brightness of her eyes. The punctum of the photograph, I'm reminding you, has nothing to do with any form of resemblance or with his ability to identify her. In a similar manner, Benjamin recognizes himself in the image of the six-year-old Kafka, standing in a similar photography studio around the same period as he did. So according to my calculations here, Kafka's picture was taken around 1889 when he was six, and Benjamin's picture was taken three years later in 1902 when he was 10. Thinking about the intersection between the two childhood photographs as a mere mistake would limit the discussion to the question of identification based on resemblance. Recognition, however, as we've seen in Barthes, is an altogether different matter. Two interesting elements come up here. First, the landscape or the surroundings of the portrait. And second, the eyes. As for the landscape, in Barthes we have this winter garden that appears as the title of the photograph and is repeated many times in the text. And this is a very interesting fact, of course, since the alternative for Barthes would be to call the photograph a portrait of my mother, or say, mother 5 years old. But he distinctly calls it the winter garden photograph. So the description of the mother and the brother that I read before is also very interestingly distinctly presented in relation to the background. So the brother has his hand on the railing, and the bridge is here, and the trees are there, etc. And Barthes also concentrates on the mother, on his mother's eyes. This is the second issue, or rather, and the unique brightness of her eyes. Benjamin, on the other hand, refers to what he calls here the infinite sadness in Kafka's eyes when he describes this image. In both the text, The Little History and the Kafka Essay, he talks about an infinite sadness in Kafka's eyes. He writes that Kafka the child, I quote, would surely be lost in this setting of the photograph, were it not for his immensely sad eyes, which dominate the landscape predestined for them. For Benjamin, the depth of sadness expressed in Kafka's eyes becomes a governing principle, a key that allows him access to the photograph. These sad eyes dominate the landscape that seems to surrender, in Benjamin's words, to the penetration of Kafka's sad gaze. So if we look closely at the photographs, we see that this landscape that Benjamin is referring to is no more than another photograph or painting that is hanging behind the child, right? On the wall behind Benjamin and his brothers, but not on the wall behind Kafka. So again, when he describes the sadness in Kafka's eyes, he describes it in relation to the landscape, but the landscape in the other picture. This is yet another putting together of the two photographs, shifting the background in Benjamin's photo to that behind Kafka's hat. The sadness of the gaze that penetrates so deeply to what is behind, right? And I'm quoting, to turn the photograph over, to enter into the paper's depth. This is how Benjamin describes the depth of the eyes, or the depth of the image of the landscape. However hard we look, we discover nothing. The turn of the screw has produced nothing. These last lines were not Benjamin's, but Barthes. So now I'm mixing between Benjamin's description and Barthes. Here we experience an interchange between Benjamin and Barthes that suddenly speak in one and the same voice or look in one and the same eye. For both authors, the eyes embody the truth of the photograph. They are the punctum. To use Derrida's account of Barthes, Camera Lucida, I'm quoting, the mark of this unique wound, or the punctum, Derrida writes, is nowhere visible as such, but its unlocatable brightness or clarity, the unlocatable brightness itself, that of Barthes' mother's eyes, eradicates the entire study. This was Derrida. But it is this absence or invisibility that drives Derrida to try and explain how it is possible that even without knowing Barthes' mother, we are still so deeply moved by her absent presence. For him, a possible answer would be to understand the punctum as a structure of a metonym, standing as a substitute for something else that is meaningful for us, that moves us and produces sadness in us. So this would be related to this idea of Barthes that the punctum is not objective, but also not subjective, because it can speak to us as well, differently, but to us. This interpretation, however, still leaves the punctum as the main reference point of Barthes, that by which we are moved, as if something is out there that moves us. I would like to offer a different explanation and a different path into this structure, and suggest that the photographs makes us sad, not because of a specific punctum, regardless of any object or person that it depicts, and independently of our personal relation to those objects and persons. Let me go back to Heidegger's account of sadness for a moment. So I just want to read again a few lines from Heidegger's Zollikon seminars. And these seminars are very interesting specifically when we think about feeling, because it's a series of seminars, of talks that he gave to psychoanalysts. So this question of feeling and emotion and the body is very strong there. And they're also very clear, these seminars. So I'm reading a few lines. I'll just shorten it a little bit. So Heidegger asks, how are we to measure sadness? Evidently, one cannot measure it at all. Why not? If one approaches sadness with a method of measuring, the very approach would already be contrary to the meaning of sadness. Remember this intentional, non-intentional. Here, even the claim to measure is already a violation of the phenomenon of sadness. But do we not also use quantitative concepts in our speech about sadness? Do we not speak of intense sadness or great or profound sadness? One could also say, he's a bit sad. But that does not mean a small quantity of sadness when we say he's a bit sad. This a bit refers to a quality of mood, of Stimmung. The very depth, however, is by no means measurable. I'm stopping the quote here. So Heidegger, the lines that Heidegger goes along describe the that insofar as sadness is concerned, it can only be shown how a person is affected by sadness. His relationship to himself and to the world is changed in sadness. This is Heidegger. So, of course, in terms of being in the world, Dasein, etc. This is why I argue that it is not the photograph that induces sadness in us, but photography. So again, it is not the photograph, the object, but the medium itself, the photographic medium. So despite the fact that Barthes, as well as Benjamin, concentrates on two or three portraits, and despite their choice of photographed subject, to which they obviously have strong personal connections, the mother, Benjamin to himself, Benjamin to Kafka, a son to his mother, an adult to a child, etc., we can nevertheless say that what the two accounts point to has nothing to do with these specific photographs, but with the very fact that they are photographs. But why photography and not any other medium? Can't a painting affect us in a similar way? A statue? Going back to the opening of my talk and the discussion of the indexicality of photography, I would say no, it is not the same. The specificity of sadness is uniquely connected to the medium of photography and not to images as such. The unique indexical nature of photography that I connected earlier to its intentional structure confronts us with the essential absence of an object. So, of course, there can be a realistic painting, but my argument at least is it's not the same. Photography offers itself on the platter of resemblance, similarity, and this unquestionable reference captured in the decisive moment, to use Cartier-Bresson's famous phrase. But at the same time, photography leaves us empty-handed. And recall the way that Barthes describes this emptiness of resemblance. So even if the photograph is, you know, completely accurate, the focus is perfect, the cropping is perfect, something is missing. To go back to the predominance of the eyes in both the descriptions, we can say that the eyes, the mothers or Kafka's, are the punctum. However, it is not due to the representation of the eyes as objects on the camera film, so not the eyes themselves, but rather it lies in their gaze that is directed outward. So again, the punctum, if we want to go and to use this term by Barthes, so it would not be the eyes themselves, but what they do, they look. The direction or the structure of intentionality is overturned here. We tend to think of the photographic act as resulting in an object that appears in the photograph before us, which is as if lending itself to our gaze, becoming the intentional object of our look, right? So if I look at the photograph, right? So the structure intuitively, as we think about it, my eyes go out to the photograph. And now, does it affect me? Do I recognize it, etc.? Here, in what I'm proposing, we find a complete flip of the structure. The observer is now the object of the photographic gaze, and not the other way around, disintegrating the intentional structure altogether. So maybe for Barthes, finding his mother means her gaze finding him. So this overturning that I want to point at is now that the image is looking out to us. The question whether we have an identification in Barthes or a mistaken identification in Benjamin is completely irrelevant to the question of recognition. Namely, to the way in which the photograph penetrates us, wounds us, and makes us sad. The tragic encounter between the promise of indexicality and of the complete absence of an object that can become the object of our recognition establishes the link between photography and sadness. So we have two very, very strong characterizations of photography that are really undeniable. One is this indexicality, reference, resemblance, and the other is the stark absence of an object. We are not sad about the loss of a mother or of childhood, not even because of the way photography faces us with the possibility of our death. The sadness of photography has to do with the medium's truth, to use Barthes' words, which is essentially what Barthes is looking for in Camera Lucida. We find this truth neither in the photographed object nor in the degree of resemblance to the real object to which it refers. We find it somewhere else, altogether outside of the photographic frame. What photography demonstrates, therefore, is the stark disappointment of intentionality, the brokenness of the promise of intentionality. Thank you.